Today's episode of the Nick Taylor Horror Show is brought to you by Diabolik DVD. For almost 20 years, Diabolik DVD has been the source for horror, cult, and weird cinema to customers around the world. Diabolik offers a one-stop shopping experience for all of your favorite labels, including Arrow, Synapse, Vinegar Syndrome, Severin, Mondo Macabro, Blue Underground, 88, and many more from all corners of the globe. So whether you're looking for the definitive version of Suspiria or trying to upgrade your crusty old DVD of Cannibal Holocaust, Diabolik is the owner-operated small business choice you've been craving. Shop online at DiabolikDVD.com. That's DiabolikDVD.com. We're also brought to you by Deadly Grounds Coffee. It's the number one choice of horror fans worldwide. Nothing starts your day or night better than a delicious cup of Deadly Grounds. Whether you're hunting ghosts or fighting the next zombie apocalypse, any one of Deadly's 30-plus roasts will bring you to caffeine nirvana with the richest flavor you've ever had. Whether you're craving their Hellhound Roast, Witch's Brew, Devil's Night Roast, or Sinful Delight, order online at GetDeadly.com for easy and safe shipping right to your door. We know that once you go deadly, you won't go back. Join the deadly revolution today. Be bold, be different, be deadly. Deadly Grounds Coffee. Coffee to die for and zombie approved. Get some at GetDeadly.com. Welcome to the Nick Taylor Horror Show. Tate Steinzik is an award-winning special effects makeup artist, writer, and director whose highly anticipated Castle Freak reimagining launches today on Shudder. Tate has worked on multiple films, including Spider-Man, Puppet Master, The Littlest Reich, Scare Package, Satanic Panic, Sharknado 2, and Dragged Across Concrete, plus many more. Tate is also a mainstay effects artist on shows like Saturday Night Live, Law & Order, and multiple titles on the Discovery Channel. Tate is a two-time finalist on Face Off in both seasons 1 and 5, and one of the show's most beloved contestants. I've known Tate for multiple years and have been a huge fan of his work. His style is one of the most interesting and recognizable of today's practical effects makeup artists, and I have been dying to see his remake of Castle Freak since it was announced at Monsterpalooza. The production stories behind the making of Castle Freak are completely insane. While shooting in Albania, where apparently horror movies are very frowned upon, the team tried to hide the subject matter of the movie, but unfortunately, the actor playing the freak, wearing the full freak bodysuit, briefly wandered outside wearing the suit, and this caused multiple local villagers to call in extraterrestrial sightings. Yeah, it was that crazy. Tate gets into all of it, into this conversation. Anyhow, he's my brother from another mother, and I always love talking to him. Without further ado, here is the awesome and fantastically talented Tate Steinzik.
My entire 2019 was dedicated to Castle Freak.
Yeah.
And creating this thing that was fucking, I was born to direct. Like, even Dallas Sonier from Fango, you know, he told me from the moment that he offered me this, he was like, I can't think of anyone more perfect to direct this than you. Like, he's, over the years, we've got to know each other on a really personal level, and you know, he's aware of my ambitions of directing, and he's read some of my scripts, and you know, we'd always talked about doing a project together in that regard. So anyway, when 2019 rolled around and we actually got into prep for this film, it's that moment, you know, where you're like, I'm now walking on the grounds of changing my life.
Yeah.
And it was insane. It was such a hard year, man, because, you know, indie budgets, first time directors, you know, we're not eating lobster for lunch, man. You know what I mean? It was a rough year because I had to put my entire special effects career behind me.
Right.
to properly pursue this film the way I needed to pursue it. So anyway, 2019 was just a blur of prep and Albania and international travels and working with a giant crew that barely knows four words of English and, you know, just all of us killing ourselves to get this movie done. And then we did it, and it was fantastic. And, you know, so just to get to, you know, fast forward to today, when today literally would have been the day that me and like all of my my fucking crew that worked so hard could sort of take this in. So it's a big bummer, you know. I feel for my crew. I feel for the whole fucking industry, man. It's just such a it's such an impenetrable enemy. Like there's nothing you can do, and that's the really ironic part. Is a lot of us that are in film, you know, we're ambitious people, we're creative people that, you know, we need to do things or we sink. A lot of us, we need to do things or we fall into fast seas of depression. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like there's a common thread of artists that we're like sharks. If we stop moving, we drown.
Right.
So like, so to see this entire like industry be sat on its ass for a minute, it's honestly frightening. I worry about a bunch of people out there, but at the same time, I'm really hoping that they're like me and they're pacing around their house thinking of ways to reinvent the entertainment industry. Like how can assume this becomes a new normal? What can we do with this?
Yeah. It's interesting to see what people are doing now that they're isolated. For instance, Roger Corman launched a whole 2-minute film festival and called for people to shoot short films in their homes and submit them. And he's going to host like a little short film festival from isolation. Sig Neutron is putting out some cool stuff now that he's just completely isolated. Yeah.
This is the best thing that could have ever happened for that guy in his brain. Like first of all, I love Sig. He's an absolute gentleman and a real true space cadet. Like none of that's put on. None of that is a character. Like,
yeah.
Homeboy rolls out of bed with a tiny alien hat on. You know what I mean?
He's so cool.
And I can't agree more. Like his new videos, I feel like on the other side of this, he's going to be offered like an Adult Swim show.
It's so weird you say that because when I was seeing some of the stuff on Instagram, the first thing I commented was like, Adult Swim needs to give you a show. You need like a perverted Pee-wee's Playhouse kind of show where you host it and you do all these practically driven skits with all these creatures and monsters. It would be beautiful.
Yeah, where Pee-wee actually gets to bang Miss Yvonne. Like, it's the thing that we always wanted as perverted little teenagers, but they never went there. That this is now Sig's mantle to pick up and take us into the world of perverse children's shows. I'm all in.
Yeah, me too. You and me both, man.
Well, I'm hoping that becomes the consistency, and I'm seeing that a lot. And I'm actually planning on doing a film for the Corman Festival.
Yeah?
I have an idea, and it's something extremely minimalist that I've always wanted to do, and it's something that I can do with myself in a room, and so I think it's a really cool concept. So, that's what I'm talking about. Just right now is the time that creative people need to be sort of stimulated and brought together and given some sort of outlet, and I think that these online festivals are a great idea. Especially if, you know, we can get some grants behind it and actually start giving out some cash prizes to people, because it's, you know, this is the time that people need that shit.
Yeah, it would be great. People do need them for sure.
Yeah.
No, it's a crazy time, but I do think that people are going to show their resourcefulness for sure. Like creators who are incapable of not creating are somehow going to find stuff to make and do. And I think some interesting things will come out of it, but it'll be very, very painful. And I mean, my heart goes out to the people who are really affected by it. I was happy to see Netflix is starting a $100 million fund for crew members who are put out of work. So, I mean, the industry seems to be doing what they can right now, you know.
That was lovely. That was such a statement of just a reminder of humanity. It's like people, man, you know, and I hate that I'm finally getting to that age that I'm starting to say things like, I just don't under fucking stand kids anymore, you know, but it's true. It's like, I don't understand just the pure lack of humanity these days. So it's nice that when you get, you know, this non-human entity like Netflix and they're like, hey, yeah, everybody that makes all of our amazing content, we're going to help you.
Yeah.
You know, I wish that more companies fell behind that, with the way of, you know, money breaks down, I'm sure that they can easily afford to float their people for a while. But
yeah, because it shows you really care about the industry and not just about making money. in the simplest terms. I mean, it shows that they really care about the people who are out of work right now.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You know, I think we should all, like, here's another sentence that would only be spawned from a pandemic. I think we should all start following suit with Dana White from the UFC, and I think we should all start compiling our friendly money together and buying private islands.
Right.
And testing 100 yards offshore, and once it's a confirmed clean person, bring them on and let's fucking make a movie.
Yeah, somebody will do it.
The 24 hours of constant filmmaking, bring 50 directors over, you know, bring a shitload of actors, test them all 100 yards out from the island, and then once we're cool, bring them on and let's just have a frenzy of filmmaking for like 6 months. It'll be amazing.
Holy shit. No, I love the idea. That would be great. It'd have to be island themed movies, but ain't nothing wrong with that. Well, let's talk about the making of Castle Freak. From what I understand, sure. It wasn't exactly smooth.
Fucking hell, man. Not smooth is something I'm used to. What I experienced in 2019 was a brand new beast, man. It was insane. But let me preface it with this, because I don't want to leave people hanging on the wrong emotion leading into the story.
Yeah.
It was absolutely a success. The reason I love directing is beyond the storytelling aspect and that ultimate power of creating creatures in the worlds that they live in. What I like most about directing is it absolutely challenges every facet of my troubleshooting ability. Like it maxes me out.
Right.
And that's a feeling that you don't get with a lot of things. So in that regard, I loved it. I loved the situation of literally having to come up with like baseball hand signals with my director of photography because we don't speak the same language.
Wow.
Not at all. Not at all. He doesn't have any words, any English words, and I had zero Albanian in me. So, you know, it comes down to a translator, which is all good and seems all hopeful and all of this in pre-production and prep and all of this when you're able to sit around tables with people with a little bit better English. You know, that's all good. But then you get on set when you only have 12 hours, 13 hours a day, something like that tops that you can push a crew of people. And you can't spend five of it translating.
Right.
You know what I mean? So it turns into these very real situations of what the fuck?
Oh,
how?
God.
How is this possible? So, you know, by a few days into it, Spiro, he's the name of my cinematographer, and he was an absolute animal. I love the guy. I've never loved someone more that I've never said one word of conversation to. It's insane. But we genuinely came up with hand signals. Like,
oh my God.
You know, we would have a hand signal for wide lens, you know, if we were going to dolly in, you know, we had a symbol for the dollies, if we're going to use the crane, you know, like, so by the end of it, it was almost like sign language. But it was really the hardest part of it was, if something goes wrong, how do you fix it? Because you can't just run to a rental house. You
right.
know what I mean? But it sort of offsets because you have, you know, one of the oldest cultures in like the history of humanity. And you have all of the beautiful like production value that comes along with that.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's a volley of, am I really going to be pissed off because I don't have a water machine? You know, because mm-hmm. I have a fucking castle, you know, so I have a bit of a different attitude than a lot of people. So believe me, if you ask some people involved in the production, it was hellfire and brimstone. But if you ask, you know, guys like me, it's like it was the greatest accomplishment. We made the best film that we could have with the resources that we had. And that is an absolute success, in my opinion.
Yeah, and I feel like that's the whole purpose of filmmaking is to overcome those, not the whole purpose, but a major element of filmmaking is overcoming those challenges
yes.
and getting the production value in spite of, because any filmmaking circumstances are less than ideal for the most part. But I love the idea of, you know, maxing yourself out as a human and how directing causes you to do that.
Yes.
And I would imagine that, I mean, the whole notion of problem solving, I know, is very, very important to the world of practical effects, because I would, that's what, 2/3 of what you guys end up having to do is solve problems on set?
Oh, it gets to the point, and like, this is going, you know, I'm very much one personality type, and there's plenty of other personality types to pick from. But, you know, it gets to the point that you almost abandon strategy, you know, and you get to the, and see, I say this to people all the time whenever I do like Q&As or conventions or whatever, I always get the same question. What do you look for in a person when you crew up, when you're about to do a film?
Mm-hmm.
And talent is usually like 5th, 6th on the list.
Right.
It's the ability to handle problems and to think your way through them. It's nerves. It's nuts. You know what I mean? Like, that is the foundation of a practical effects artist, is to have a director yelling at you with 50 people standing behind them, twiddling their thumbs, waiting to do their job until you can figure out how to make this impossible thing happen in the next 10 minutes.
Right.
You know, like, that's fucking pressure. You know what I mean?
Right.
And that's not something that everybody can just handle. And I've seen people crumble. Like, I've seen people that don't drink become alcoholics on the same film.
Oof.
You know what I mean? Like, it's crazy, man. And those are the things that unfortunately separate the pack. It's like, you have to be able to handle your shit. You have to be able to look a problem in the eye and fight until at least you can say to yourself, I did everything I can to make that different.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's, it's the same thing goes with directing. It's just a matter of, you know, trying to stick to a vision, but not compromising, you know, your possibilities in doing that. There's a lot of, I try and ride that wave of, okay, this is what I wanted, but that's not going to happen unless I absolutely, you know, compromise this element and this element, and this element in the production. So, you know, you start to compromise in ways and fix things, and ultimately you get everything you want. Like, we didn't miss anything on Castle Freak.
Yeah.
You know, there, if we missed a couple of scenes, we were able to pick them up the next day or in a couple of days. Like, we got everything we needed to shoot and we got everything beautifully. But the process of getting that can be absolutely maddening. You know, I say everything with a much lighter heart because I'm the director. I'm the creative, you know, free floating butterfly fucker, you know, but like, talk to my production manager. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, talk to him and ask him how he enjoyed Castle Freak. And it's a completely different story, you know? So, but then again, you know, his name is Seeger. He's an absolute like militant maniac and I love him. He's also in a metal band, so he's fucking cool. he did things that my personality type wouldn't handle. Like, I would be driven to throwing fists in places that he was still working through the problem professionally.
Mm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so we all have our different challenges and we all have our different rewards. Like, when he would fix one of those problems, that was his reward. Whereas my reward was, you know, seeing a giant bloody head flying through the air and a laughing creature in a fucking, you know, 2,000-year-old castle. Like, that's my shit.
Yeah.
You know? So anyway, long tangent, but small story is, you know, it was a really, really, really trying and challenging production, but I can confidently and honestly say it's such a creepy and fucking good film. And,
oh,
and I really wanted to take it back to the place of like, Hammer horror, that feeling of Hammer horror, because you know what, I'll be honest, man, like, I'm an 80s kid and like, I really wish I had been able to get in on the sort of retro, the new wave of retro films. But at this point, like, it's too late to stick your toe in that pond.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's too many Turbo Kids. There's too many of that shit. I fucking love all that shit. Don't get me wrong. But like, I'm not going to go try and make that movie. Whereas 10 years ago, that was the only movie I wanted to make.
Right,
you know
right.
what I mean? So my new sort of like being true to myself and what are my influences, I'm starting to with Castle Freak, I wanted it to feel like an old Hammer film, which is a completely different feeling than that 80s VHS retro world. But it's still something that's true to like, you know, my inspiration. So we definitely have that piercing, eerie dread, which also is what you need for a Lovecraft story. You know, Lovecraft are, they're not quick burns. You know, like you have to establish dread, and you have to establish the fact that there's a looming, you know, evil, a presence around you at all times.
And right.
That's something that really worked with that sort of Hammer horror feeling. So that's something I wanted to instill from the beginning.
Yeah. What I know that Castle Freak in particular was the original one, was a pretty important movie for you. So what was that like, having to adapt something that was so seemingly so pivotal for you at a young age? Like, you saw that when you were really young, from what I understand. And
yeah,
it was one of the first movies that was amoral, and it seemed to, yes, you know, warp you to a certain degree. And I understand it, because that movie's nihilistic as fuck. But what did you want to bring to a new adaptation of Castle Freak, considering how important it was to you?
Such a good question. It was integral to me. It's the first time that I felt truly frightened and morally crossed, and then my response was to grin and uncover my face. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like that was a moment for me that I started to understand myself a little better. So, you know, Castle Freak meant a lot, because, you know, a lot of people find Castle Freak because they're huge Reanimator fans. I was the opposite. I found Castle Freak, that was my first Stuart Gordon film. So Castle Freak led me to Reanimator, Bride of Reanimator, Dagon, you know, all of the greats. Which now, in Stuart's passing, you know, the film takes on another complete, I'm telling you, man, this year has just been, it's insane. I first of all, memoriam to one of the greatest directors,
absolutely,
in horror history. Love the man, and it was such an honor to reboot a film that was inspired by his mind.
I was so devastated when he passed. I actually got to interview him a few months ago, and it's not aired yet because we're going to air it.
Yeah. I never had the chance to talk to him, which was my one of the main reasons I wanted to do Castle Freak, was so, because you know, when you get these sort of, like, I never could have envisioned this. This is a scenario I never could have envisioned as an adult, that, like, a movie that I loved as a child, brought to me by the magazine that I was obsessed with as a child, asking me to recreate this. You know, it's like,
yeah,
I could never have conceived that being an actual real thing. Those are like childish thoughts you have as a teenager, you know. But I found
so
myself
cool
living that shit, and my so you start thinking, you know, okay, well, if this can happen, what else can happen?
Right.
And I started thinking of my instant, like, head movie, as I love to put it, from my boy Simple Jack. my initial head movie was me and Stuart sitting in a screening room together, watching my interpretation of Castle Freak and just talking.
Oh, man.
And that was my goal. I'm like, oh my God, well, I'm going to set this as a new benchmark of what absurd thing I might accomplish for a redneck from Oklahoma. What the fuck else is going to happen? Who knows? You know,
yeah.
So, you know, and I'm, you know, so that was my real goal. I wanted that moment. And, you know, it sucks that, more obviously not the selfish aspect of it, but I just wanted him to see it. And I wanted him to know that how much that his movie meant to me, that, you know, I've rededicated my life to create a fantastic fucking version of something that he conceived, you know.
Yeah.
I just wanted that moment. And, but now it takes on a whole new thing. Now it's, you know, I've created an homage to one of my favorite directors of all time that I get to give to the world in time that I think the world needs some cool shit. So
absolutely.
It's just a whole, you know, life keeps spinning, man. You know, you just got to start, keep reevaluating yourself with each spin. But,
yeah.
You know, anyway, I'm very blessed. You know, I'm blessed to have been able to do that. And I think that the Castle Freak fans are going to be very pleased with the careful treatment and respect that, of course, they should all already know, in having Barbara Crampton literally there on set with me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that wasn't an accident that she ended up in Albania with us. Like, you know, while everyone knows and trusts me, because I've worked with Fangoria for so long now, let's be honest, I'm a first-time director. Like, they're sending me to another country. This is a really loved and cherished film.
Right.
Like, let's send Barbara to make sure that this shit stays on track, because, you know, people that know me know that I can very legitimately work in, like, aliens and shit into every conversation. And you know, Dallas probably had a fear that, like, behind the castle, suddenly a fucking lit disc rises into the, you know, and then the whole time Castle Freak was a fucking, you know. So anyway, I'm sure that there were some silent thoughts about, we should probably make sure someone keeps Tate on script. And Barbara did a great job of that. She, listen, man, she is such a wealth of knowledge.
Wow.
And, like, it's another one of those moments, because, like, let's be honest, who wasn't in love with Barbara Crampton?
Oh, yeah.
You were a teenage horror.
Still am.
So, exactly. I know. And then you meet her, and she's wonderful. And it's like, man, this is crazy. You're here, Barbara, and we're in Albania, and we're making Castle Freak. So, anyway, it's cool. The entire experience was the best of my life, and I could not have done it without my amazing team, man. Justin Martell, Matt Mangiariti, Sigrid Dixon, those guys, you know, they produced a bunch of trauma stuff, and they produce the Joe Bob Briggs Drive-In.
Oh, so, wow.
Yeah, so it's a big circular family of horror fans that all came together and made this film. So, you know, it's cool, man. It's there's nothing. I can't find a better job. I'm such a fucking Pisces, man. I'm too dueling conversations in my head at all time. Like, if I can't be a film director, I'll literally be a hermit on top of a mountain, a hunter-gatherer. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So those are my two. That's the crossroads I'm at. So we'll see where things go with Castle Freak and the future of that. And if not, I'll leave society to you, and I'm going to go fucking hunt a deer.
Sounds like a good backup plan to me. Well, your effects background must have really helped, just in terms of giving you the resilience to get through things not always working out and having to just do quick thinking on set and being super resourceful. I mean, I would imagine that really helped as a director, right?
Well, yes, it helps in the regard that I trust my instinct. I trust myself after years of, you know, pulling some crazy shit off. I don't second guess myself a lot, but I also surround myself with people who I trust, and their opinions matter to me. And so I have that safety net of people that, you know, I'm not one of those people that's like, this is my job. Fuck you and your concept. Like, that's a ridiculous mode of thought. Everyone is a professional for whatever reason. They became that good at their job, and it's stupid to not respect their position. So surround yourself with great thinkers and you will succeed.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I wasn't as afraid of that, but specifically about the effects, you know, there were many times on set that I turned to my AD and I said, you take the monitor. And I ran to set and got down and dirty with my boys and made some shit happen, you know, because, you know, that's the kind of thing that you have to do. You have to get in there. I was just as blood covered as my effects crew on this. you know,
yeah.
There were times we were all in there together. You know, I'd sign language with my cinematographer. We'd work out our shot. I'd go to my AD. I'd have him watch monitor. And then I'd get in there with my effects guys and we'd make this gag happen.
Mm-hmm.
And loved it. It was old school 80s filmmaking. It was fucking, it felt like Castle Freak. And that's what was great about it. It wasn't some polished, like, you know, $300 million remake of something 80s. It was, I mean, I would be surprised if our budget wasn't comparable to the original. You know what I mean? Like, we were out there making an 80s movie the way they, hey, I love that shit. I also had a great team. I had Ben Bornstein, who's the key on Gotham. He does, he did all of the stuff on Gotham, all those great Joker makeups. And,
oh, that's great.
Eric Zapata Eric Zapata from, Fear of the Walking Dead. He does Dwight's makeup. I had Allie, from Some Devil Effects. He came over and managed all my blood gags and Melissa, who works with him, Melissa Popsell. You know, I had a, a really great crew and make sure. Enough. Oh yeah. And then of course the incomparable Wayne Anderson, who, I worked with on, my freak suit. That guy is a damn powerhouse, and all, he'll be on every production. Every production I can pull off. Jeez, I cannot wait for the world to see, the monster that we've created.
It's, yeah, I can't wait too.
Very, very proud.
That's great, man. I know you can't give too much away, but what can you tell people about the effects in this movie and your approach to the effects?
Oh man, I wish I could just spew. not an effect pun either. Yep. I'll say this. I try to make things that I enjoy and that creep me out. You know, like monsters don't scare me. I'm far beyond conditioned to monsters. And to be honest, monsters never scared me. Even when I was a child, I preferred monsters to people. That's why I love Clive Barker's story so much, is, you know, humanity was always the bad guy.
Right.
You know, so I don't, what scares me, and from that point, what scares me is humanity. What scares me is the evil in man. Mm-hmm. What scares me is religion. What scares me is crazy fucking people. And these are the things that I let rule on this set. So that said, I mean, obviously everyone knows that this is, you know, based on a Lovecraft story. So that blows away the doors of reason.
Oh yeah.
You know, I can do whatever the hell I want, which is probably why Dallas sent Barbara, because UFOs could have become involved. See, I found a way to make it make sense. And that's why I need a babysitter.
Yeah.
But anyway, moving on, the effects, I prefer, if I'm given the choice, I prefer to approach things from a manner of what it would actually look like. And I mean that in a way, because there's something primal that the human eye understands. Like when you watch a Tarantino flick, you're not unsettled when a head gets cut off, mm-hmm. because it's a geyser of blood that hits the roof. You're overjoyed. It's like a roller coaster.
Yep.
And it serves its purpose for that type of film. But when I want to unsettle people, I want to go to that primal route and make you feel like you're seeing something you shouldn't. And the way you do that, there's a special way to do it with anatomy. Don't use too much blood. Like, let the actual visual gore, like, rule through. People would be surprised. Like, I don't know how wild a kid you are, but I had many, many fucking needs for stitches in my time. And if you've ever had, like, a massive, like, erupting wound, it's more color than it's red. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? You see yellows, you see purples, you see blues, you see all sorts of stuff inside you besides the color red. And there's something about allowing some of that anatomy to show that just irks people. And that's the thing that I really wanted to rule. So I sort of tried to paint this whole visual with the brush of reality, from the look of our freak to the way people, in all of the creative ways that they're eviscerated. I tried to keep things in a realm of believability while still having that copious amount of gore. I mean, let's be honest, if I'm directing a film, people are going to be torn to pieces.
Naturally.
But yes, of course. But I did it in a way that I felt was believable. And I think that adds to the real unsettling nature of all of these visuals.
Well, that's fascinating. I mean, in that regard, are most gore effects that you observe completely unrealistic? If you are bringing this whole other level of realism that is unsettling to gore effects, do you find most gore effects, and is that the purpose of most gore effects, is to be kind of in that uncanny valley where it's gore and it's fun, but if it's too realistic, then it rubs people the wrong way, so to speak? I mean, are most gore effects not realistic
choice? No, you know what? But I don't know. At some point, the answer to that would have been yes. But there's so many generations of filmmakers since that that look, that spaghetti Western color, that fucking of blood I'm referencing. There was a point that yes was the answer to that. And I'm just unsure at this point how many generations of filmmakers have come since and just don't know what it looks like. But right. Then again, I don't expect everyone what it's supposed to look like when you cut a human open. Mm-hmm. You know, like, it's privileged knowledge. You have to work for that shit, you know?
Yeah, of course.
So there's not a lot of people running around saying that's not what it looks like. You know, a lot of people probably think that, you know, that if a zombie bites your arm, that the blood sprays everyone in a 10-foot radius. You know, it shit just doesn't happen like that. In fact, like, the deeper the wound, the less it bleeds, because you start getting into muscle and things like that, things that have less of a blood density.
Right.
So. So that's when you, and that's what I love about working with Craig Zoller. That's what I love about working with fucking Zoller, man.
Yeah.
He wants to see the gore, not the blood. Like, there were so many times on set that I would be prepped for a blood gag, and he's like, no, just the gag, not the blood. Hmm. Like, he would want to see the effect of a flesh flap blowing open from a bullet hit, but he wouldn't want to see the ejection of blood.
Mm.
You know what I mean? Like, yeah. He had a very specific vision of that. And I marveled at it, because I'd never been on a set before where somebody that was a gore hound didn't want blood. And I respected it so much, man.
That's interesting.
No, and you can tell it. And dude, it's the only time I've ever been nominated for a prestigious award too. It's see, that's the crazy thing.
Yeah.
Like, I got nominated for a Saturn Award. It was me versus the fucking Avengers, man. It
wow.
was stupid. Yeah.
That was for Dragged. It was for Dragged Across Concrete. Yeah, there were some notably unsettling gore effects in that movie, for sure. And
yes.
Now that I'm realizing it wasn't blood covering it up. Yeah.
Yes. Exactly. See, and that's a key, man. That's a key to, like, stepping over that visual barrier that we're comfortable with. The color red is like a big blanket that hides you from all of the stuff that your primal human knows is bad.
Right.
Like, if a giant predatory monster bites a chunk out of your midsection, you're going to look down and see browns and yellows and blues and really pretty shiny whites and all of these colors that let you know you're fucking dead.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And that's, so to circle the conversation back, that's what I tried to go with in the film, because I wanted to make people uncomfortable.
Yeah.
I don't want people to scream because it's a roller coaster ride. I want silence in the movie theater.
Mm.
You know what I mean? I want rigid, like, I want neck aches, you know? And that's the kind of film I wanted to make. And I fuck it. I feel like we did one hell of a job doing it, man.
Oh, dude, I can't wait to see it. My God. I remember reading somewhere you discussing the state of horror today versus the horror that you grew up on. And I don't remember exactly what you said, but it was something along the lines of that there is something really missing from horror today, for the most part, that was there, you know, back in the 80s and 90s. What do you think that is? Can you articulate what is missing in horror and to nowadays?
You know, man, that question, it's something that I debate in myself a lot, because, you know, I'm getting to an age where I'm beyond my feeling of immortality, and I'm starting to get into more of a reflective state of who I am and the things I've done, and you know, that sort of, and it's not something that I'm used to. It's not something I honestly ever anticipated I'd make it to. So, like, I'm at this stage where I'm how this relates to what you just asked me is, there are times that I feel that this thing that I love, this art form that I love so much, horror films, have just declined to a degree of it's just visual fodder, next one. You know what
right.
I mean? There's no compelling content. There's no love. It doesn't feel like you're being immersed in a universe. It's just fucking boom, visual, cash the paycheck, next in line.
Mm.
And that drives me crazy. But at the same time, this is where what I just said kind of falls into this. I don't know if what's missing was just that genuine awe and wonder that I had as a child watching those films, because I assume that those kind of films have always been around. Mm-hmm. Just the fucking cash a quick paycheck and get out of there. So what I guess my answer would be, horror, it needs people like me and like you that still have that feel, can still remember what it feels like to sit in front of the static glow of a television, to touch your curved television screen and feel static pop between you and it. Yeah. And you're watching this VHS film that you're not supposed to be watching, and it's terrible quality, which just adds to your imagination because you're not overly bombarded with fucking pixels that tell you what to think. You right. know, it's there was a magic. And I'm afraid, and this is where a fear rises in me, that because then it becomes something that's much harder to fix. I'm afraid that the problem is we've just sort of fallen into a realm of time that there's no innocence, there's not a place left for innocence and imagination. Like, everything is fucking spelled out. Mm. And if that's the case, then I'm a relic already. I'm already a dinosaur, because all I want to feel is the things that I felt as a kid watching these films. And whether what I'm referencing is content or it's just that innocence that I had as the viewer, either way, I want that to be my job, to make more fucking movies like that for other people.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because I feel like there'll always be a need for that. But then again, it could be a dying art, man. You know, epilepsy might be evolution, you know, and people need to see 800 frames per second in the future in order to stay engaged.
Right.
You know, like, I don't know. That very well may be a thing. Who knows? It's kind of the way things are evolving if you look at cinema in general. Like, when's the last time that you could just let a shot linger without somebody telling you it's time to fucking edit?
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, I feel like all this 80s nostalgia is partially due in part to, well, my big theory about 80s nostalgia, to get really macro about it, is that it's because of the lack of practical effects in most movies nowadays. People are yearning for a time period where they believed everything they saw on camera, which they don't anymore because of CGI. I don't mean to knock CGI entirely, but I mean, and it's not just with building creatures and effects and stuff like that. It's other effects like car crashes and explosions. People just don't believe it anymore. And on a visual level, you can watch the Avengers, and those movies are a lot of fun. But you walk out, and it just doesn't last. You know, it doesn't have lasting power. Whereas in the 80s, I mean, that was the time period when special effects makeup really had its heyday. And the creations that were coming out between Botine and Steve Johnson and Rick Baker and all those guys and K&B, just they were so indelible for people because they believed them, because they were really tangibly there. And I think your subconscious yes. can believe it. So I think that it seems that people are yearning for that because people are starting to have this digital fatigue for movies just being too polished and just not believable because of that.
No, you know what, man, you're 100% right. And I agree. And you know, I don't ever want to sound, you know, as if my perspective is in one direction only versus the other. And you know, a great example of that, like, I don't know, have you seen the, have you seen any of the Carpenter Brute videos? Do you know?
No, Carpenter Brute? I listen to Carpenter Brute. I haven't seen any of their videos though.
Okay. You need to go see this thing. They're making a movie right now called Blood Machines. And, it's funny. I was actually talking, to their cinematographer about joining me for Castle Freak. He was very, very, very into it. And unfortunately he had something with Netflix come up and he wasn't able to come over to Albania. But yeah, you and the world listening, do yourselves a favor and go look up Blood Machines, look up Carpenter Brute and their videos. They're an entity called Seth Eicherman. It's just such a cool style. But it's all it's a mixture of technology, our modern technology, but used to create retro visuals.
Huh.
And it is the most it is the most relaxing thing I found. Like, because the thing, my newly conditioned eyes are satisfied with these pristine HD visuals I'm seeing, but that piece of me, that little kid touching the static of the screen, is also satisfied because they're purely writing their visual story based on the 80s and retro homage.
Yeah.
So it's just, and I love that. And that's why I reached out to him and asked him to, you know, to be the cinematographer for my film, because I wanted to marry a lot of digital attributes to a practical lead. And that's because the combination is beautiful, but just like you said, it's, if you lean too far in one direction, you're always going to fail.
Right.
And like, there's something to be said for not being able to just step back and get a widescreen shot of a giant monster running at you. What you lose in doing that is having to creatively compose a series of frames to tell the same story. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
And I feel like that's why you don't walk away. Like, you walk out of the Avengers, you know, with a belly full of popcorn and a big smile. And then, like, I have to watch it again a week later to remember anything about it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Whereas, like you said, when you're a kid, or even these days, when you watch a good horror film, like, let's be honest, when Hereditary came out, we were all running to each other's houses to talk about those moments.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And that's why there is still a brilliance to be found in horror. It's just, for some reason, people aren't doing it. And I don't know if it's a race to make money or whatever. I know, see, that's where my ability to think ends, because I don't give a fuck about money. Otherwise I wouldn't be living on a ranch in Oklahoma. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I want to create. So, you know, I don't know. That's where I start walking that fence of like, fuck, have I already become a relic before I even got started? Because I want to make things that matter. Mm-hmm. I don't want to just pound out an epileptic fit visual frenzy and call it cinema. And cash a check for it. I don't have interest. That's where the fork in the road goes for me, and I end up the hermit on the hill. You know what I mean? I'll just go have a garden instead. So, you know, so I still have the hope that there is that hunger for these horror films that have a soul.
Oh, I
and
think it's
I
there.
I think there is.
For sure. Yeah, no, I mean, I think people are demanding more practical effects-driven movies, and I absolutely think it's there for sure. And I think it's only going to get bigger, you know, because I think that they're embracing the blend between practical and digital, and people just want things that are handcrafted nowadays. They just they believe it.
The thing is, these days there are companies out there that have, and I've never, only in the past couple of years have I ever dared to say this word, but perfected practical makeup effects.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, there are companies out there that can do anything practically.
Yeah.
And the crazy thing was, is there have been for a long time. We both know that Steve, back XFX, could have done anything a director ever wanted.
Yep.
Practically. You know what I mean? And that's the crazy thing. See, Steve was ahead of his time, is what it was. Mm-hmm. If he was right now as motivated and genius as he was back then, he would be ruling this industry. But the thing is he peaked at a time where everybody was making films like American Werewolf in Paris.
You know
what I mean? They're like, this is the next way. These really terrible looking creatures with fucking non-believable hair and eyes.
Right, right.
You know, like, and that's the crazy thing. But by the way, how is Steve?
He's doing okay. He's not been feeling great as of late, but and of course he's convinced he has the coronavirus. But other than that, he's hanging in there. He's doing okay. Couple little health issues for a while, but he's hanging in. What are you working on, right? Or what are you sculpting right now? If you're at liberty to talk about it.
Yeah, no, because like I said, the film industry is kaput. Speaking of retro, and I need to get this word tattooed on my body somewhere, apparently, but like I've sort of become known for creating these retro recreation masks. And like, so I started with Bebop and Rocksteady. I did a Bebop and Rocksteady, and I did them in my style, I made them super realistic with like flesh textures, you know, the warts and wrinkles and, you know, cuts, and gave them little battle scars.
Yeah, I think I saw that.
And so, you know, I had fun with it. Basically what I did was I took one of my favorite cartoons and I ran it through the makeup effects artist filter. And, a lot of people dug them. So I did a couple more. I did a turtle. I did Leo, and I did Shredder, and then I did Splinter. And then, I got contacted by this company called Pristine Auctions, and they asked me to create these for them so that they can have Kevin Eastman actually, illustrate a pedestal and sign them, the display pedestal that my head goes on. So, and it turned into this whole thing. So I'm like, oh, this is really cool. I'm actually being paid to recreate, you know, some of my favorite characters of childhood. So anyway, that turned into, I've been getting a lot of like custom orders to recreate retro cartoon characters into makeup effects worthy, you know, results. So right now I'm doing a Thundercat.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, dude, it's super cool. And it's I'm totally taking it into a world of you know, the big cat owns the skull, not the human. You know what I mean?
So
I'm making it really gnarly and very realistic, but I have a whole like list of these things plotted out, man. My next one is and this one I may have to fucking retire after this. This might be the pinnacle of feel good times for Tate, man. But I'm going to do Manny Faces from He-Man, and I'm actually going to have the ability to rotate. You know, your face is one of them. You know, you have to put the little red eye marker on, or the little eye mask thing, but it's going to have the rotatable robot and the lizard face.
Oh my God, that's crazy!
Yes, it's going to happen. I've already designed it and figured out how to do it, and after that, I'll probably, you know, I'll move on to the garden thing.
But. Yeah, there was so much good stuff on TV for us as kids in the 80s and 90s. It was cool and it was iconic and it was edgy in a way. Because I feel like so many cartoons nowadays, there's nothing that comes close to Ren and Stimpy. There isn't anything as action driven and like strangely erotic as Thundercats.
Right?
There's nothing now for kids. It's all so toned down.
I mean, well, the look at Thundercats, man. Like, it's such a dark story. I mean, their planet exploded. Their entire civilization was killed. You know what I mean? And they land on a planet full of monsters. Like, it's everything was like dark subtext back then. But then they just sort of made it, you know, happy on top, I guess, to keep the critics away. But I've long been pushing for a live action Thundercats movie.
Weren't they going to do that?
Weren't
they going to do that? I thought I heard they were doing a Thundercats movie.
I've read several times that it was supposed to happen, and I don't know. There's a couple of things that I can't figure out that makes me feel like our industry is rigged, and that's one of them. Why the fuck don't they have a live-action Thundercats movie? And
it would do so well.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. It would be amazing, man. But why isn't there a new Swamp Thing? Like, the series... I'll be honest, I only saw like a little bit of the series. It looked great. It's one of those things that I need to sit down and catch up on, but just purely from an Alan Moore perspective, like, why isn't somebody making a Swamp Thing movie right now?
I don't know. I don't understand it. I don't understand why the series got canceled. I didn't get to see it just because I didn't want to sign up for that DC Plus or whatever it was. I might at some point.
It's like $69 to watch just that series.
It's gonna be like The Mandalorian, where you sign up for it and you watch the whole season and then you unsubscribe and then you just get back on as soon as Mandalorian comes back, like Disney Plus.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, man, I don't know. In fact, like right here, like less than 3 feet away from me is my stack of Alan Moore era Swamp Thing comics.
I never read the comics. I loved the movies as a kid. I would quote the hell out of the movies. And I had the action figures and I loved the cartoon, but I never read the actual comics.
I tell you what, man, what you should do is you should pick up, you can find them relatively cheaply on like Amazon or eBay, but hold on, let me grab it and then I can tell you. They condensed all of the Alan Moore editions of Swamp Thing into graphic novels. He did like issue, what was it, like 12 through like 35 or 40, something like that.
Okay.
But if you get the Saga of the Swamp Thing, they have like book one, book two, and book three, I think. It's all of the Alan Moore stories condensed. And man, they're just, I mean, they're insane, the levels of creativity and the places that they go. That's why I keep it out, like away from my other comic and magazine collections. I keep my Swamp Thing pile available because I still reference that shit for inspiration. Wow. You know what I mean? Yeah, Alan Moore is—he's otherworldly, man. He is alien, and he graced us with a little bit of presence, and then he's going to take off into another universe and do his thing there. Like, he is absolute magic, man. But yeah, do yourself a favor, and you'll see what I mean, because it has that feeling that I'm talking about, and maybe I'm putting this together for the first time in my life. Why I like to make movies like that, but. My dad used to get me Swamp Thing comics from the corner store when I was like 4 and 5, and they were my fucking favorite. That I lived for the Swamp Thing comic books. But when you read Alan Moore's work, there's this underlying dread and this just sort of magic, like overall nature of things that he uses to allow anything to happen, and you buy it. And some of the stuff that happens is so fucking sinister and monstrous, man. I'm really, really surprised they let kids read this shit.
Wow.
There's some terrible stuff. In fact, one of the, cause you know, there's a few of those Corman type, film festivals going on right now. And, one of them, I was going to shoot my version of like a two pages from one of those comics, which was a guy that was in a car wreck and he was hung upside down and bleeding and torn to pieces. And his mouth was agape and he was hallucinating this fly moving towards him. And he was talking to the fly, and the fly and him were having this terrible conversation about, the fly was offering to end his life. All he had to do was let the fly crawl down his throat and he would turn it off. He's like, your pain will come to an end. You won't have to deal with this agony anymore. And there were these drawings from Steve Bissett of this guy with his teeth knocked out and his eyes giant and white with blood dripping because he's hanging upside down in this overturned car and this fly just moving towards his mouth. You know what I mean? It's crazy shit to give to a kid.
Wow.
And that's the shit they gave me.
Yeah.
But anyway, so do yourself a favor, especially during all this, order one of those on Amazon, man. It will give you some brand new, like, creative flourishment. I guarantee you.
All right. No, I'm totally into it. It sounds awesome. Yeah. Cause I mean, was such a big fan of the movies, but never went to the source material. But now I think you're right. They're just, kids are not exposed to really scary stuff anymore. And the kids movies that were on when I was a kid, some of them were terrifying. Like Something Wicked This Way Comes was super scary. The Witches still scares the shit out of me to this day. But even in cartoons, there's nothing scary for kids anymore. And I feel like it's just such a loss. And I feel like because of it, kids are not growing up nearly as tough. I think it does toughen your resolve to have the right gateway horror material.
Yes, you're 100% right. Like I remember, I mean, some might find this questionable. My parents let me watch Poltergeist when I was like 5.
Nice.
You know what I mean? I mean, they paid for it. They regretted that forever because of the nightmares that I had. But like, there's, I don't know, man. It's been forgotten that what is scary is what you don't know. Mm. Like, even if you're in the room with a werewolf, if you're looking a werewolf in the eye, you have the ability to at least think strategically, deal with this, assess this, like I'm assessing this situation. It's when you don't see something, it's when something is around you and you feel vulnerable and unprotected. That's where fear comes from. You know what I mean? And that's not something you get in modern films because everything is seen and spelled and told out. And I mean, I suppose that that's its own sort of storytelling style, technique, you know, it's fun from like, I guess like, for lack of a better term, a comic book perspective, mm-hmm. like, you know, you want those visuals laid the fuck out for you. That's right. What you like. But when it comes to specifically horror and specifically mystery and suspense, that's not how it works. Visuals are the antithesis of horror and mystery and suspense.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's been oversighted to death, but the old Jaws example is really indicative of that, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, how did that happen? It took their production crumbling to actually pull off that correct level of suspense, because mm-hmm. if that shark hadn't malfunctioned, we would have seen it from the beginning of the film.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it actually took a mistake to make the perfect movie.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny the way that works. If you're a resourceful director, that you can find that magic in scenarios where the chips are down, so to speak.
That's, man, listen, in my opinion, it's that specifically is the most fun in directing. That right there, figuring out how, because that, man, there's such a reward when you lay down to go to sleep that night and you're like, holy shit, I fought a giant Rottweiler mountain dog to get my, you know, to get my shot today. Those are the moments, man. That's what it's all about.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that's awesome, man. Well, listen, this is a whole bunch of fun, dude. I could easily talk to you for another couple hours, but I know you got a sculpture to make. But shit, dude, real good time. Real good time catching up.
No, it was super good, man. And listen, dude, feel free to give me a call during all of this.
All right. Here, as always, are some key takeaways from this conversation with Tate Steinzik. Number one, deliver the gore without the blood. This is an interesting point that Tate observed from working with S. Craig Zahler. On a lot of Zahler's movies, as brutal as they get, they're not always very bloody. This is perhaps most noticeable in Brawl in Cell Block 99, and the effect is actually quite chilling. When you don't have blood to cover everything up with, the audience can observe even more visceral nuances like bones crunching, sinews snapping, internal organs being pulverized, etc. Tate attended the Tom Savini School, so he knows blood, but this bloodless approach to gore was something he was very inspired by. I love a good bloodbath as much as the next guy, but as a horror director, it's important to learn how to innovate and do these things a little bit differently. So don't be so quick to douse everything in blood. Less can be more. Number two, surround yourself with people that you trust. Filmmaking, particularly low-budget filmmaking, is putting yourself at the mercy of Murphy's Law. Things will inevitably go wrong. As a director, it's important to realize that you're one person, and you're incapable of making all of the decisions and executing all of the quick thinking required to address all of the many problems that will plague your production. To try is to quickly and easily burn out and make yourself crazy in the process. Therefore, it's critical to have a crew of people whose opinions you value and make the decisions for you that will keep your movie on track. Unfortunately, I hate to say it, a lot of film sets are plagued with toxic egos, backstabbers, too many opinions, and even saboteurs, all of which can collectively zap everyone's energy and erode the very foundation of your movie. Tate's been working on movies for many, many years, and luckily had a number of trusty contacts to call on when it came time to make Castle Freak. It takes a while to find these people, of course, but once you do, do not let them go. Treat them like gold. They can make or break your movie, and they can give your production a flow, a speed, and a stability that you simply cannot accomplish by yourself. Number three, enjoy the tough times. Tate talks about how directing is firing on all cylinders because it taps every single ounce of energy, creativity, and reserve that you have. To Tate, this is a wonderful feeling and something very much to embrace. One thing you notice as Tate talks through all of the trials and tribulations that happened on the Castle Freak shoot, he's never complaining. He's never annoyed or resentful for the difficult times. Instead, he has gratitude for every ounce of difficulty that this movie presented him with. That's what filmmaking is. As a director, your worth is not always calculated by the quality of the movie that you make, but by the severity of the challenges that you are able to overcome. That's what a lot of producers look for in directors, problem solvers. When production challenges present themselves, are you going to buckle under the pressure or prove that you have an iron reserve? Despite the difficulties of Castle Freak, Tate embraced the growth that the experience provided him with. He'd worked on enough movies to expect the journey to be difficult, so he loved every single painstaking minute of the process because he knew it was making him a better director. Anyway, guys, thank you as always for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, why not share it with your friends and family on social media? Don't forget to follow the show on Instagram at I'm Nick Taylor and on Twitter at the same handle. Thanks again for listening to the Nick Taylor Horror Show.